I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan. This episode of Sascapes is sponsored by the Saskatchewan German Council. The SGC is a provincial nonprofit umbrella organization to nearly 40 member groups representing all people of German-speaking backgrounds. By engaging people of all ages to become active and involved partners in a vibrant multicultural community, the SGC is committed to the preservation and promotion of the German language, traditions, and culture for all people of Saskatchewan. You'll find the link to their website in the show notes. This is the second in a series of special Sascapes podcast presents entitled German Culture Alive, all sponsored by the SGC. You can hear the first in this series by listening to episode 93, recorded during the 2020 Christmas holiday season. This is episode 95 of Sascapes, and I welcome you. Okay, imagine you're attending a relative's funeral and you ask a question about your grandfather. You're handed a piece of paper upon which is written a list of sort of a family tree of relatives. This information unleashes a newly found passion for your family's history, a passion which would eventually take you to another continent, meeting relatives you never knew you had, and tracing the footsteps of your past. That is where my conversation with my guest Merv Weiss begins. From there, Merv walks me through the history of Germans living in Russia, part of his family history. Today's descendants of Germans living in Russia are a significant part of the German culture of Saskatchewan, and like all cultures, adds to the landscape of our province, which we know is rich with tradition. So, what's the takeaway? Never hesitate to ask a relative questions about your family. Who knows what adventure you'll find yourself on? By the way, please take some time to read the show notes for this episode. You'll find several links that are pertinent to our conversation, including Merv's personal website. Merv Weiss, thank you for joining me for this episode. As I've said with every episode I've recorded in the last little while, we're in pandemic times, and I feel the need to say that just for no other reason than to have a history timeline, so when people listen to this years from now, they remember that we're all living under extraordinary lockdown circumstances. And I say that because you're literally down the street from me, and I could probably walk to your place in about 20 minutes. But here we are. Here we are in our separate homes because that's the COVID way. So you're not that far away from me, but I'm glad that we have at least the ability to talk this way by phone. And I'm looking forward to the chat because, as I mentioned to you last week, this really is going to be an educational journey for myself. And I also expect will be the same for a lot of listeners. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about this specific subject, which in broad terms will be talking about the heritage of Germans from and living in Russia. We'll dive into that shortly, but first of all, I want to get to know you. So I know that you're from Saskatchewan. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on a farm near a small town in southwestern Saskatchewan called Fox Valley. It's halfway between Maple Creek and Leader, and close to Medicine Hat, which is on the other side of the border in Alberta.
So you come from farming people?
Absolutely, farming people, yep. Yeah.
And how many generations of your family have lived in that area and farmed?
Well, only two before me, my dad and my grandfather.
Right. So if there were two generations before you, would the third generation earlier be the earliest you're able to trace your relatives that would have come here from Europe, from Russia specifically, Germans living in Russia?
Several generations beyond my grandfather, for sure, back to the late 1700s. In what is now Germany, there was no Germany at that time. But my particular Weiss line starts in a small city called Bruxelles in Germany. It's near Karlsruhe. And the first Weiss ancestor who left that region and went to South Russia left in 1804.
Oh, okay. So it's, you would go quite back, far back, and definitely would not have met those people.
Well, definitely my grandfather would be the only one. And I never met him. He died before I was born.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So then I guess the question begs, what ignited your enthusiasm for this particular part of history and how it relates to your family? Had you always been a history buff growing up as a kid, or did you come to this fairly late? How much of your heritage was part of your growing up?
I guess I've always been interested in history. At university, I had a double major in history and mathematics. But nothing specific was ever shared with me, I guess, at home. Nothing much specific. I always say that I grew up German without realizing it, because my whole community was German, really. And almost the whole entire community was Catholic as well. And I often tell, or try and tell, a joke that I think I was 10 years old before I realized there were other people in the world besides German Catholics. So, but that interest in, you know, where my mom came from, where my dad came from, was always there, except that I never pursued it. I guess I was never encouraged to pursue it. There's no one else in the family that, like uncles or aunts, that had pursued it. And so I was 50 years old already before I really got interested in my family's history and my family's genealogy. And it's been an overriding passion and pastime since then, I must say, for the last 20 years. How I got started was after attending an uncle's funeral in Medicine Hat. And so we're at my aunt's house, and I asked a question regarding something about grandfather. And my aunt says, "Oh, wait a minute, Frank, that was my uncle. He wrote some stuff down on a piece of paper." So she gets up and goes somewhere else in the house, a closet or bedroom. She comes back with this piece of paper, and right on there, there's, it's written by my uncle. It had the name of my grandfather, where he was born, the names of his parents, the names of his siblings, and also then the name of my grandfather's wife, my grandfather, or my grandmother, her parents, the names of her siblings. And I'm looking at this and just astounded. And I look up at my aunt and say, "How come I'm 50 years old and seeing this for the first time?" You know, and she just shrugged her shoulders, of course, but it took off from there. And I was kind of annoyed, you know, that that no one had ever shared this information with me before. And my dad was a great guy, a hell of a good guy, but it just wasn't a thing, I guess. And I often tell the story that there's a rural cemetery near where I grew up. And how many times would I have driven by that cemetery? And my dad never once ever said, "You know, I have four siblings buried in that cemetery."
No kidding.
Yeah. Never once did he say, "There used to be a church here. I was baptized in that church." He's too busy raising a family, making a living, I guess. I don't know how else to explain it. We had a good relationship with my dad, and we really did. He loved his kids. All his kids loved him, but it just wasn't of interest to him, I guess.
Thank goodness that piece of paper with that family tree had been written down somewhere, and that
exactly,
someone
exactly
had the presence of mind to hang on to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you've been on this passion project ever since?
Ever since, yes, ever since. And it's taken me back to Ukraine, which is what used to be part of Russia, And our ancestors always referred to it as South Russia or Sud Ruslan. They never used the word Ukraine because the word Ukraine never came into general usage until after World War One. But I've been back to Ukraine six times, not necessarily do research because there's nothing to research there, really. It's just giving you a sense of the land. And two of those six times I led tour groups over there myself. And this quest has led me to find and locate many relatives who now live in Germany, having returned there from different parts of the Soviet Union since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1989. So I've been over to Germany several times to meet with relatives. Most are second cousins, but there were a few have died since I started doing this, but there's still two first cousins to my dad alive yet in Germany.
Wow, what was it like when you first met up with them?
They were as excited as I was, put it that way.
I bet.
They really were. They had no idea they had relatives in North America, in America. They always say America, Canada is just America to them. They had no idea, none of them. Only one first cousin who has since passed away, first cousin of my dad, knew that there was a branch in America. But none of the other cousins I knew had any inkling of the story of my grandfather and that he left. They didn't even know he was part of the Weiss family. They were also amazed that I knew more than they in terms of names and dates, but they were well aware that the Germans had lived in this part of Russia since the early 1800s, yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good segue. From what parts of Europe did the first Germans who immigrated to Russia come from, and what period of time are we looking at? What dates, roughly?
There's two main groups of Germans that went to Russia. At the invitation of first the great Tsarina Katharina the Great, and those Germans settled along the Volga River near current cities of Saratov and Samara and Volgograd. And they left in 1763, 1764, in that time frame. They settled in what is still part today called Russia. And I have not researched that group, those Volga Germans. And there's lots of people that have. There's an entire genealogical association devoted to researching the Volga Germans. The other group that I have researched are generally referred to as the Black Sea Germans because they settled along the north shore of the Black Sea in what is now today called Ukraine. And they were invited there under similar circumstances by Katharina the Great's grandson, Tsar Alexander the First. And these people were attracted there with various incentives, much like the Canadian government attracted European settlers 100 years later. In addition, the Germans, besides being promised an exemption from military service, they were given their own systems of local justice, like non-criminal cases, for example, theft and stuff like that could all be handled locally. They had their own, they were in control of their own system of education. They were guaranteed the right to speak the German language and conduct business, everyday life in German. So those kind of, besides the free land and free money to free loans to get started with building materials and so on and purchase building materials. So there was a range of incentives to attract not just Germans, but anybody in Europe if they had agricultural background. That's what the Tsar was looking for, is agriculturalists, which included farmers and then also agricultural tradesmen. And so that's the specific segment of Germans in Russia that I'm most familiar with, the Black Sea Germans, and they, as I mentioned earlier, began leaving 1804, 1805, and continued on to about 1820, and altogether about 100,000 of these Germans migrated south and east into different colonies that had been set up by the Tsarist government along the north shores of the Black Sea.
Was that terrain, that climate, that the quality of the earth, was that conducive to good agriculture? Did they know that in advance where they were coming, or did they struggle for the first little while thinking, we're not sure whether we will be able to grow anything on this kind of land?
You're right. The first few years were very, very tough. And, well, they had no idea the quality of land they were going to, and even the Russians didn't. I mean, it was just, they used the word steppe land. It was just wide open grasslands.
Right.
Wide open grasslands, and there were nomadic tribes that very sparsely populated moved through there grazing the land. The biggest trouble those earliest farmers, if you want to call them that, had was breaking the sod, because the sod was so tough. It had been rooted over thousands of years with that grass. And to start with, they only had, if you can believe that, plows with, made with wooden shears.
Wow.
Steel shears didn't come, or shears, I guess, plow shears didn't come along until later. But the first colonists, as they were called, tried to break that land up with wooden plowshares. And it was very, very tough from what I've read. Climate is not that dissimilar to what they left behind in Western Europe. Perhaps a bit milder, a bit less snow. A lot of regions didn't get as much rain as Western Europe, so they had to learn to cope with that. And the further south you go, particularly into Crimea, where my mom's family comes from, there it is even drier and warmer. So besides plowing the land, they also had years of drought to worry about, which were uncommon in Western Europe.
Wow, those must have been very difficult and lean years to start off with. I wonder if they thought to themselves, what in the world have we gotten ourselves into?
No doubt.
So what,
but the chance to be free of the control of landowners. In Western Europe, they were never landowners. You know, they were just a step ahead of serfs. They were really tenants whose lives were controlled by the people who owned the land. So they were looking to get away from that. They're looking to improve their economic conditions. Plus, the other brilliant big motivation to leave was the uncertainty of the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon's armies were crisscrossing Western Europe at the time and raiding the villages for food and fodder for the horses, and even capturing young boys that they took along to look after the horses and things like that. So they had lots of reasons to leave. And when the invitation from the Tsar came along, hey, that must have looked like a good idea to a lot of them.
Right. And eventually they were able to tame the land. They became very successful. The crops flourished, yes?
Yes. The first years were tough. As I've mentioned, we read stories about the plagues with locusts or grasshoppers, as well as the drought. The other thing that really plagued the new settlers the first few years was disease. Many children and adults died, specifically children, due to disease in those early years.
So I'm wondering, how was this received by these great political figures that had invited them? Had they had expectations, and did they feel like these Germans were missing the mark, as it were, or were they fairly tolerant and willing to have them struggle and weather through all of those conditions in hopes that they would become successful? Because I'm assuming that their economic boom for themselves meant an economic boom for the country as a whole.
Yeah. Yes, they did. I mean, they were very carefully scrutinized. There was a special office set up, one in Odessa, one in another city of Dnipropetrovsk, that supervised all the everything that had to do with these German colonies. It was called the Foreign Settlers Office, or the Guardian Welfare Office. And everything was closely monitored, all the conditions in the colonies, and they knew which colonies were doing better than others and things like that. And I would say they were catered to a certain degree at the beginning, encouraged. And the German colonies, you know, after about 1850, became very successful along the shores of the North Sea, Black Sea.
Hey, it's Kevin.
I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the SaskApes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the SaskApes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called SaskApes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When SaskApes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Were they welcome? Were they welcome? Was their presence welcome by Russian-born citizens? Did they mingle well within the culture? Were they accepted, or was there sort of some animosity?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Almost the way it was set up, the colonies were expected to keep to themselves almost. You know, the fact that they were guaranteed use of their language, and they had their own school system, they had their own local justice system, they had their own local municipal councils, and all that was conducted in German. So it almost by design segregated these German colonies from the rest of society. But it's my understanding that the Germans got along well with all of their neighbors, and the point needs to be made as well that these Germans were very much always in a minority within the greater geography of the region they were living in. Besides ethnic Ukrainians and Russians, Bulgarians, Greeks, even French, Jewish people, they were always a minority. I forgot to make a point earlier that these Germans served a very specific purpose because they were the first permanent settlers along the north shore of the Black Sea. And it was designed that their presence and development of the land would discourage further Turkish invasions from across the Black Sea, because that had been Turkish territory up until 1787 or whatever, somewhere in there, the Russian-Turkish War, where Russia defeated Turkey and took control of that land along the north shore of the Black Sea. And so to hold on to it, they came up with this idea to colonize it and bring in permanent settlers.
It sounds like this period of time in history, Russia became quite a melting pot of various cultures.
Always was, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Always was, yeah.
As a side note, were you ever able to track down where the Weiss descendants would have settled?
Oh, absolutely. I know the house where my grandfather was born. In what is today Ukraine, in that village, absolutely, yeah.
What's the name of that village?
It's called Zelz, spelled S-E-L-Z. That was the German name given to it, or that the colonists chose for it. The name has undergone a few changes, but currently it's called Lamanska. And it's about 60 kilometers northwest of Odessa City. And yes, I've been there on each of my 6 trips to Ukraine.
Eventually, agriculturally, these people became very successful. How did their presence evolve? How did they advance from those early years to success? You said that they were given this land. Did they eventually become so wealthy and successful that they were able to purchase other land?
Yes. Well, at the beginning, when they first went there, a lot of the land was owned by nobility, and they didn't live on the land. They needed people to farm it. So the government purchased blocks of this land, and that's what they used to colonize the steppe lands. And those are the blocks where they moved these Germans onto and said, here, build a colony here. And they were scattered all along. There's hundreds of them along the Black Sea shore. And they did not have the right to purchase land individually or privately. As they got more successful, some of them were able to as a group, as a colony, add more land to the acreage of their colony, but it was always communally owned. And the reason they had to do that, in order to keep farming, you know, so there's a farmer and his wife, and they have 10, 12 children, and there's six sons, and they all want to farm. So all he could do at the start was divide up his original land allotment for his sons. So that, after two generations, that was pretty watered down. Each person had pretty small holdings, and that's why they were looking to buy more land, but always as a community. Then, beginning in the 1860s, Russia freed their serfs, their huge serf population, and began to change the land ownership laws with the idea that, oh, maybe these serfs will start buying land on their own, but there's never any provision to help these serfs borrow the money to do that. But anyway, when those land reforms opened up private ownership, that's when the German economic success really took off in the 1860s, where individual German colonists or farmers could buy their own land. And after that, they became very successful. They can always continue to live in their villages and just have kept going further and further out to farm their land to the point where they were sometimes gone weeks at a time while they were farming before they came back to their home village.
As a side thought, was it discouraged for Germans to become involved with Russian-born citizens? Was there intermarriage going on eventually?
Very, very little. Very, very little.
That's interesting.
From about 1900 on, in later years, again, in the church records, which I've spent a lot of time studying Catholic church records and Lutheran church records, there's the odd interfaith or inter-ethnic marriage, but Germans tended to stick to themselves and marry within themselves.
Interesting. So, okay, now when did things start to fall apart? This sounds like a very successful time for them. Things eventually started to fall apart. What's that part of history?
And remember, they were given all the original manifesto, gave them all these guarantees in perpetuity. And in this case, in perpetuity meant until about 1873, when Tsar Alexander the I, he had this mantra that Russia should belong to the Russians, and began a series of reforms that took away those special settlement privileges that the Germans had enjoyed for just about 75 years. The first one was that they lost their system of local municipal government, and the colonies were amalgamated into bigger counties, if you like, and then these counties were administered by Russians rather than Germans as before. They lost control of their school system. The education now had to take place in Russian. They were only allowed 1 hour a day in German. And a huge concern for many, many families was they lost the exemption of military service, and that from 1874 on, a German man over the age of 20, when they reached their age of 20, they were eligible for military service. And military service was 7 years, I believe, at that time. That's when things started to fall apart, going back again to the release of the serfs and their struggles to try and find their place then in Russian society, and their failure to obtain land and means to for an economic livelihood. And they saw all these wealthy Germans. That led to real resentment in the peasant class against the Germans. Coupled with all of that, the Tsars became very nervous of the growing power of Germany, the new Germany that was just created in 1871 by Bismarck. And I'm not exactly sure why Russia, such a large, powerful nation, sort of was so immediately nervous about the growing power of this new Germany in Western Europe. But there were certain, and so because the Tsar deemed Germany to be an enemy, it goes by connection that the Germans within the Russian Empire were suddenly suspect then of being loyal Russian citizens. which is nothing, from what I've read, nothing further from the truth. The German colonists regard themselves as faithful and loyal Russian citizens and recognize the Tsar as their ruler.
As they were stripped of all of these rights, was there a large segment of this group that decided to leave and perhaps go back?
Well, more stayed than left. That's true. Very few looked to go back to Germany. Some did, but very few. The majority from 1880 on, began to look overseas because by coincidence, by the coincidence of timing, first of all, the American government, the United States, they opened up their homestead lands in the West and enacted homestead laws similar to the ones that attracted these Germans to go to Russia to begin with. These immigration companies and land companies and the government, the United States government, began to advertise overseas, hey, we need settlers and farmers to come to America, the land of the free, you know. And 20 years later, Canada, 15 years later, Canada took up the same approach. And that's all goes to do with timing. We had to wait until we had a railway in Western Canada before we could start encouraging people to come into Western Canada. Whereas the United States was ahead of us in railway development. So the majority of the Germans who left came to North and South America. We can't forget South America as well. Very few returned to Germany. They were farmers, and if you wanted to be farmers, you wanted to get land.
I had read, and I don't know if this is specific to the Volga Germans that you had spoke about, but I had read that eventually some of these Germans living in Russia, they were driven out under very harsh conditions, exiled almost, deported to places like Siberia. Is this the same group of Germans living in Russia, or is this a different group?
That happened to both groups. It happened to both groups beginning with the start of World War One. Don't know how much back I'm going to give into to World War One here, but Germany and Russia found themselves at war. And the Germans the Germans and Russia were really deemed enemies already of the state because the country was at war with Germany. And one of the first laws enacted when Russia entered the war in 1914 was to move all Germans that lived within 150 kilometers of the border away from the border. They didn't trust any Germans living that close to the border. And that's affected more primarily the Russian province of Volhynia. And over 100,000 of them were deported immediately in 1914, dragged out of their homes and shipped in by boxcar loads to Siberia, to the east, as we always say, behind the Ural Mountains, even leaving the fields, the crops standing in the fields. And the mortality rate has been estimated at least one-third just in the movement of these people into Siberia. But the war had gone so badly, so quickly, Russia never had a chance to move any more than that. So the next great evacuation or exile or banishment began to occur then after the Russian Revolution. And as the Bolsheviks established their power, any objectors, whether they were German or otherwise, they were dealt with on the spot by execution or shipped east. That continued, that repression against the Germans would continue right up then through Stalin. When Stalin initiated his five-year agricultural plans, he forced all farmers, whether they're Germans or Ukrainians or otherwise, to join collectives, to turn over all of their property, their animals and agricultural equipment and their land to the collective, and it would be farmed collectively under the Soviet system. Anybody who objected to that, again, was dealt with on the spot or shipped east.
Were those who managed to stay alive during this terrible period of time able to find their way to North America eventually?
No. From 1928 on, Stalin locked the doors. He was so alarmed at the numbers of people wanting to get out of Russia that he closed the borders altogether and denied exit permits for anybody. And so anyone after 1929 was really caught behind what became what we call the Iron Curtain. And those people were forced to live in Russia against their will until World War II. And that opens up another whole page of history. Germany invaded Russia June 22nd, 1941. And Stalin's immediate reaction was to start moving these Germans east. All the Volga Germans, about 400,000 of them, were transported to the east. By to the east, I mean, very Siberia is a general word. You know, it covers a vast area. Kazakhstan often comes in as an equivalent to Siberia, but it really isn't. 60,000 Germans out of Crimea were shipped east through the first in the, through the Caucasus and then further east in, behind the Urals. A great many east of the Dnieper River were also shipped east. But Germany's invasion, and that, Stalin's plan was to evacuate all the Germans to the east. But the Nazi army, the Wehrmacht, with their blitzkrieg, they advanced so quickly that by August of 1941, they already had possession of Odessa. And so that stopped Stalin's movement of Germans to the east. So all those Germans living west of the Dnieper River, really, and you have to assume geography, they remained living in Russia under Nazi occupation, which turned out to be a rather benevolent time for them, although it only lasted 2.5 years. But with these Germans occupying that country now, they allowed them to, you know, speak their German again. They allowed them to open their churches. They allowed them to open their schools and teach in German. And they allowed, you know, some private entrepreneurship again. And so for many Germans, they felt that they had been liberated by the Nazis. So there was a certain amount of, sympathy, empathy maybe, or I'm not sure, right, support, emotional support for the Nazis, mm-hmm. which we don't like to admit, but mm-hmm. let's be honest about it. However, that German occupation didn't last that long, 30 months roughly. And after the Battle of Stalingrad, when Germany was defeated, the Russian army began to move west to reclaim the territory that had been occupied by the Nazis. And seeing this, all part of Hitler's master plan of creating this Aryan utopia in Europe, now in 1944, late 43, 44, it's Hitler's decision, I'm going to move all those Germans back into Western Europe so that Russia can't have them, so to speak. Besides that, most of them got settled in Poland, where Hitler's plan was to settle these Germans on farms that had previously been confiscated from the Polish people, because he needed farmers, he needed food to keep the German nation alive. So beginning in late 43 and through the spring of 44, the remaining Germans, basically, the remaining Germans in South Russia, were forcibly moved by horse and wagon and on foot up into Poland and Eastern Germany, where they were first held in refugee camps, where they were all registered. And this is all well documented for any researcher. And then they were placed on farms or placed in homes as domestic help. Or many were set to work in factories, especially armaments and munitions factories. And that's how it went until the war was over in the spring of 45. And then, you know, the worst fate possible for these Germans who had just been forcibly evacuated in very recent months. According to the terms of the Yalta Agreement with Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin, Stalin had the right to reclaim them as Soviet citizens, which in fact they had been when the war started. These people were Soviet citizens, regardless of their ethnicity. So Stalin, according to the terms of that agreement, legitimately reclaimed these Germans as Soviet citizens and, again, shipped them en masse to the east into the gulags, where they provided free slave labor for 10 years. 10 years these, till 55, 56, these Germans lived there without rights, without citizenship. 1955, 1956, yes.
That's not that long ago in historical terms.
And so I've met the cousins in Germany who can tell you in very real personal terms about those experiences, yeah.
I want to jump back to what you had spoken of a little while ago. The Germans who came to North America, who were invited to North America, much under the same circumstances as they had originally been invited to Russia. What time frame, what years are we looking at when that mass migration into North America and then eventually Canada?
Into North America, late 1860s, 1870, a trickle. Didn't really take off until late 1870s, 1880s. And into Canada, specifically Saskatchewan, because we're the only province really that factors into this migration. There was a few in Manitoba, they were Mennonites, and a few in Alberta, but not to the same numbers as in Saskatchewan. They started to trickle in the mid-1880s, 1885, 1886, first ones arrived at Belgoni, down in the south by Regina. And that gradually picked up steam until 1895, and it really took off then because the government was really encouraging it and advertising in Europe for homesteaders. I want to say 1913 was a peak year, the maximum number, the highest number of Germans from Russia that came to Saskatchewan in that year. And that happens to include my wife's grandparents.
And I would expect the land and the climate was a bit more hospitable to them getting their agriculture off the ground than it had been when they first came to Russia.
Well, certainly it was just as challenging. But they had quite an improvement in technology, for example, in methods of plowing. Plus, as I understand, the sod here wasn't nearly as difficult to break up as the sod along the north shores of the Black Sea, what we call the steppe land. The sod in Saskatchewan was easier to break up. But the climate was a bit drier. The soil was a bit lighter as a rule. It wasn't as fertile as the steppe lands of South Russia, where the black earth has been documented as being several feet deep in places. Notwithstanding the fertility of the Regina Plains, which is famous for its agricultural productivity, the climate was typically a little drier here. And definitely shorter, definitely a shorter growing season, and colder winters would have been the biggest obstacles that the settlers had to face here in Saskatchewan. I would say it was those cold winters. I know my wife's grandparents, they emigrated with two young daughters, so both of which died that first winter here in their sod house.
These are hardy people.
Well, they had to be survival of the fittest, so to speak.
Other than Belgoni, what are some of the key parts of the province where these Germans from Russia settled?
Oh, boy. Big cluster around Estevan. And that reminds me of another point I want to make up later on. I'm just going to make a note here on paper so I remember. There's a cluster around Estevan, of course, and up along the east side of Saskatchewan, up the Langenberg, Melville, to that Yorkton area. The Belgoni, Vibank, and Condal, that whole area to the south from Belgoni, that developed first. Then I would say after that, probably the Tramping Lake Reward Macklin area to the west here from Saskatoon. Allen, Saskatchewan, just outside here of Saskatoon. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the area I grew up in, that southwest corner, Leader, Prelate, Fox Valley, Richmond, spilling across the border, Schuyler, Alberta, Scepter, Lemsford, Lance, that whole area is predominantly homesteaded by Germans from Russia. Some people are going to be screaming at me for missing out on areas.
Well, you couldn't possibly cover all of them. What was the note that you had made about Estevan?
Oh, many, when you talked about the hard times, of the first people that came, one thing that was different as opposed to those first Germans that went to Russia was among the early homesteaders in Saskatchewan were tens of thousands of American German Russians, if you know what I mean. These were Germans that had left Russia and first settled in Minnesota and North Dakota and South Dakota. And as they ran out of land, as their sons and grandsons wanted to farm, they needed more land too. They began spilling over into the border as Canada opened up the Western Plains. And these Americans brought along with them several things. They brought along machinery already. They brought along livestock. They brought along money. They brought along the English language and the knowledge of how things worked in the new world. So all of that helped the Germans, too, that came directly from Russia. They were aided by their countrymen who had been here one or two generations already in North America. Understand my point?
Yeah. No, you actually answered the question that I was going to ask you. So that's interesting. Then the question begs, why did the descendants of Germans from Russia, why did they not identify with Germany the same degree as the expats from Germany?
Yeah, good question. I think part of it. Let's go back to 1804 when my ancestor, Franz Weiss, left his town where he grew up and where he was born, and he left for Russia. There was no Germany at the time. There was no such thing as Germany geographically or geopolitically. He left a state called Baden-Württemberg. So all these Germans that went to South Russia, they never had any emotional bond to a country called Germany, because Germany wasn't created until 1871.
Right.
And I think that might have been part of it, you know, that they always considered themselves Germans. Ethnically, they were Germans. But here in North America, they tended to associate more with Russia. That's where they lived and grew up, and where they heard stories from their ancestors, from their grandfathers. Well, they were Russian stories. They weren't German stories. Follow me on that?
I do. And so,
and,
yeah.
But more specifically, the Germans over the course of 200 years in South Russia developed different ways, different customs, different foods. I heard an amusing story once about after the invention of the bicycle. So all these Germans are living down in Russia, and they learn about this bicycle. They developed a different word for bicycle. They didn't know that the Germans called it a Fahrrad, because there was that separation, or you know, that geographical situation. And they ended up actually developing their own words for certain things as things developed, like railways and trains, and just to name a couple of examples. So there's that physical separation of these people from Germany itself that didn't lend itself to identifying with Germany as a homeland. And so they didn't come to North America with any fondness or attachment to Germany.
But are you concerned that now in present day, there's a tendency to lump German history in Saskatchewan all together without differentiating between this very specific part of German heritage?
Well, I guess I'd like to ask who is lumping them together. Certainly descendants of Germans from Russia in Saskatchewan, especially of my generation, we know that our Germanness comes through Russia rather than through Germany. I suppose the general population, though, you're right, if I said I'm ethnic German, I'm of German background, I would get lumped in with with Germans from Germany. But the majority of people of German descent in this province have the same ancestry I do. To give you an example, go back to 1910, during the Homestead era. The 1916 census, in the 1916 Western Canada census, 110,000 people identified themselves as ethnic German, but only 15,000 of them were born in Germany. About 12% is the number that I've read of ethnic Germans in Saskatchewan in the early years actually migrated directly from Germany. The rest came from various parts of Eastern Europe, and the majority of those from the Volga and Black Sea areas. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that we are lumped together. I don't, not at all. We're all German people, and I know certainly SGC, the Saskatchewan German Council, we're more focused on what unites us than what makes us different.
Yes, I was going to ask you. So you are on the board of the yes. So is that really what that organization has meant to you? How long have you been involved with them? And you really summed it up nicely as to the mission statement of the organization.
Well, I haven't been involved that long, really. I guess I've been on the board my fourth year, yes, and my second year as president of the board of directors. I was involved indirectly for many years from about 2005 on, in that I attended the German language school for adults. And through the German language school, I became slowly aware of SGC, Saskatchewan German Council, because my teacher was a director and also then a president of SGC. And that's how I became more aware of SGC and became involved. And I've tried to do what I can to get more Germans from Russia involved as well. Because SGC started 35 years ago, and it was basically an organization for expatriate Germans. It was a way for these Germans from Germany living in Saskatchewan, a way for them to get together and to socialize and maintain their culture and their identity and their language, and came up with a range of programs to promote their Germanness. And what I've tried to do is trying to find a place for the Germans from Russia descendants in that mandate.
That's one of the reasons why you choose to do the presentations that you do. And then I added pre-COVID times, of course. You're probably on hold with that right now.
Yes. I've given many presentations over the years in many locations. Just part of my desire to make sure the story of the Germans from Russia isn't forgotten, especially here in Saskatchewan. We were such a dominant presence in the homesteading era. And the 2006 census tells us that still 28% of Saskatchewan's population identify with being in whole or in part ethnic Germans. We're still the largest single ethnic group, unless you combine Scottish, Irish, and British. If you combine them, they will always be bigger. And even in this COVID times now, this Sunday, this Saturday, a week from now, I'll be giving a presentation at a virtual conference. I did one previously in September. And it's not the same as giving a live presentation because you don't have any feedback from your audience. Usually you can tell if you're connecting with your audience or putting them to sleep, but virtually you can't.
Who is your audience? Who do you find is attracted to this part of history? And are the majority of them people with German heritage?
Yes, absolutely. The majority are people wanting to learn more about their Germans from Russia heritage, yes.
And do you find some of them coming up to you and giving you feedback and saying, I had no clue, I had no idea?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I get emails regularly, sometimes daily, people looking for help. Certainly weekly. A week would never go by right, not getting a new inquiry, or someone who's contacted me a couple of years ago and let it die if it and picks it up again. Well, I belong to several different organizations that that gets my name out there, whether I want it out there or not for that purpose. But I don't mind. I really like helping other people rediscover their German-Russian roots.
Well, you can add me to that list of people who say, I really had no idea. I truly didn't.
Okay.
And now I do. Are you worried that the younger generation, I always ask this and it seems so cliche to ask, but are you worried that the younger generation of German, of people with German heritage are caring less about these kinds of details? Or I guess that's up to the family to keep it alive.
It really varies from family to family. No, I'm not worried about it. I'm not concerned about it. Life evolves. You don't have control over most things in life. For those families that have control of that they make sure that, and I can name some families where it's very important that they maintain the traditions that they learned from their parents and grandparents, and other families, it's less so. It's just a fact of life. I'm not worried about it. I'm doing what I can to spread the word. But again, the people attending these presentations are typically, 50 plus age group. You wouldn't find many 30-year-olds in the audience. And is that bad? Is that wrong? No, I can't comment on that. It's just the way it is. If they have their moment of enlightenment when they're 50, the way I did, great. Mm-hmm. All the material's out there. You just have to go looking for it.
Or wind up at a family funeral where somebody pulls out a piece of paper and says, surprise.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Of course, so much more has been done over this last 25 years with the internet. There's so many virtual groups everywhere to help people. So much information online that the communication is so quick. I'm always marvel at the research that genealogists did in the 70s where they had to snail mail a letter to somebody miles away and include a self-addressed stamped envelope, hoping to get a reply. And that might come a month later, whereas now, same day answers.
I appreciate the time you've taken with me. It's really been an eye opener. I'm so happy to feel like I'm more informed. I think we can never be too informed about various cultures and their stories. So it's been a gift to me. Thank you.
Well, the German culture in general, not just the Germans from Russia, I feel have played a great role in the development of Saskatchewan. And we see that with the current German expatriates living right here in our own city, right to the researchers and the academics at our universities here and in Regina, and what they're contributing to agricultural innovations particularly comes to mind. One of the leading COVID researchers up at the university from Germany.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, that's important because this is a really important period of time. So
I want to mention too that Germany has an honorary consul living, a resident right here in Saskatoon as well, Dr. Michael Ilk,
yes,
who is also an agricultural scientist and researcher, in semi-retirement now, I think, but very involved at the university and in definitely agricultural research. And he acts now as Germany's official representative here in Saskatchewan. So like these expatriates that live here in Saskatchewan, they can go to him for passport renewals, for example.
He's also the director of the German Council.
Yes.
Murph, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate your breadth of knowledge on this subject.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I always say that I'm glad to be invited to places I haven't been to before because I'm running out of people to tell my stories to.
Well, you've been invited to my virtual place, which really is the telephone, but we'll try to. I try to make it as homey as possible for you.
It's been good. I've appreciated the way you've led me through this all.
Hey, thanks for listening. Music for Saskapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. Saskapes can be downloaded from iTunes, Google Play, the Saskapes app for Android devices, and all of the other major podcasting apps. Stop by and say hi to us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Sascapes. So tell me, what fuels the culture in your community? Who has a story that must be heard? Consider bringing Sascapes to your part of the province. Email us at sascapes@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Please share your thoughts on this episode or any of the episodes by writing a review in the iTunes Store or Google Play. Your star ratings help our audience grow. Remember, our stories are our legacy. Now, somewhere around the world for years to come, stories like those found in Sascapes are being heard. Think about it. We're creating an oral archive so that who we are in this province is never forgotten. I'm Kevin Power. Join me again next time. The Sascapes podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported in part by Kinexus. So, the next time you're stuck in traffic for a while, here's some things to think about instead of why is the car in front of you going so slow? Or if the car behind you is trying to hitch a ride on your bumper? What if your bank was committed to working with you to achieve your goals? And what if they cared enough to get to know you? And what if they weren't successful until you were? And what if your financial well-being drove everything they did? So come see why things are different at Kinexus. Stop by any branch to learn more about how Kinexus cares. Direct West is a proud sponsor of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. So is marketing getting in the way of running your business? Things like updating your Google listing, thinking of a headline for a billboard, or making sure your website is in good shape. That's where Direct West comes in. You can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com.